Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
If you look at the geographical map, you'll see that Arctic is an important, critically important region for the country.
Russia is about to undertake a new project to string a high-speed internet cable across its northern border. Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, an anti-piracy group is forcing internet providers to block access to the Pirate Bay, but it doesn't always work.
So people who really want to go to the Pirate Bay, they can. It's no problem at all. There's at least 1,000 ways to get around this block.
Plus, scientists in Scotland are working on a sign language to English smartphone app. But first, speaking of smartphones, why is there a growing trend to bring patent claims in German courts? All that and more this week on Spectrum. Since Apple released its iPad in 2010, tablet computers have become some of the hottest devices around. Tablets, like smartphones a few years before, are the latest must-have accessory for tech-savvy consumers. And the competition is fierce, as the market for smartphones and tablets is amongst the fastest growing in the tech world. In Germany, the battle for the market share is largely playing out in the courts, with many major companies suing each other over alleged patent violations. Sonia Dean reports.
Shiny, slick, and brand new. I'm gazing down a tantalizing line of tablets and smartphones at a recent Samsung trade fair near the Dusseldorf airport in western Germany. The fresh tech practically begs to be handled. I play with new handwriting recognition software on a Galaxy Tab while the Samsung rep describes the new products.
This is the 10...
Genau, das ist 10.1N.
Right, that's the 10.1N. That's basically the version that violated the Apple design patent.
The N on the Galaxy Tab 10.1N stands for new, because after a court ruling last year, Samsung had to modify its design. Within the last year, global tech companies such as Samsung and Apple have been suing and countersuing over the design and technology patents behind smartphones and tablets. From South Korea to Australia, the US to the UK, it's been happening in courts around the world. What's at stake is a market worth hundreds of billions of euros. But more so than any other, German courts have become the preferred battlefield. District courts in the three cities of Düsseldorf, Mannheim, and Munich specialize in patent disputes, handling more than 1,400 every year. Stefan Leek is an attorney with the Düsseldorf firm representing Samsung in its Galaxy Tab design case against Apple. He says there are several reasons why tech companies are battling it out in Germany. First of all, German courts are fast.
Germany is very efficient. In Düsseldorf, at the moment, it takes approximately 15 to 18 months. And in Mannheim, it's a little bit quicker. It takes normally 8 to 10 months until judgment in the first instance.
That's compared with 2 or 3 years in the U.S., for example. Expert judges in Germany preside over trials that dispense with juries and time-consuming pretrial discovery. Aside from being efficient, costs are also capped in German courts. But there's another, more important reason Germany has become the preferred venue for such patent litigation.
The primary reason for which patent holders choose Germany so often as a venue in which to bring their lawsuits is that it is excessively patent holder friendly. The German courts are very lopsided in their approach.
That's Florian Müller, an industry analyst in Munich. Take the Düsseldorf court, for example, which handles up to 600 first-instance patent cases every year. There, companies claiming patent infringement by their rivals win about two-thirds of the time. Compare that, Mueller says, with a 5% success rate at the International Trade Commission, a quasi-judicial venue in the U.S. where many major companies seek patent victories. But it's not just that claimants have a good chance of winning in Germany. There's also the extent of legal damage they can do to their rivals. Again, Düsseldorf attorney Stefan Leek.
If the claimant wins the case, he can ask for an injunction, he can ask for damages, he can ask for disclosing information, he can ask for recall of the products.
And that's what happened in the Apple-Samsung case last year. The Dusseldorf court ruled that the Galaxy Tab 10.1 violated Apple design patents, ordering Samsung to immediately stop selling it. Samsung lost on appeal and had to redesign the product. Since last year's ruling was on a European Community design patent, Apple was able to stop Samsung from selling its Galaxy Tab 10.1 across nearly all of the European Union. Although a week later, the court revised its ruling, limiting it only to Germany.
We have now the situation that the 10.1 is marketed all over in Europe except Germany. We call it the donut because it has a hole in the middle.
So here's Germany's draw for patent litigators: a fast-moving legal system with predictable costs, a 2 in 3 chance at winning, and potentially wide jurisdiction, a corporate lawyer's dream. But some warn that all this litigation is bad for business.
Large companies operating in this market see this unfavorable environment in litigation, and that is a major turnoff for companies to do this kind of business in Germany. The problem is even worse for small and medium-sized companies. The current situation is unsustainable and unbearable, and there is dire need for reform here.
Back at the Samsung Roadshow, a product presenter is describing how Samsung is specializing in smartphones and tablets.
Und wir haben im TN-Bereich Galaxy Tabs, wir haben Smartphones, wir haben das Note.
We've got Galaxy Tabs, we have smartphones, we have the Note. All of our tablet computers are also telephones, in contrast to the Apple devices. I can use this to make phone calls. The competitor can't make the same claim.
Das kann der Mitbewerber leider nicht.
This competition, both in the marketplace and in the courtroom, is bound to be fierce for years to come. Sonja Dean, DW, Düsseldorf.
And now it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The Pirate Bay is a file-sharing website founded nearly 10 years ago in Sweden. Users download BitTorrent files that can be used to obtain pirated videos and TV shows. Earlier this year, Sweden's Supreme Court ruled that it would not hear the final appeal by its founders, who have been battling an intellectual property case for years. The four founders, who have since moved out of the country, face prison sentences and a combined fine of $6.8 million US. Since then, there's been pressure in various countries around the world to block access to the site at the ISP level. Right now, there are two cases currently ongoing in the Netherlands trying to overturn that block. Peter Teffer reports from Amsterdam.
Since February, customers of the two Dutch internet service providers Ziggo and Access4All have no longer been able to visit the piratebay.org, .se and a number of other copies of that famous BitTorrent website. The two ISPs were forced by a judge to block the site after being sued by the Dutch anti-piracy group Brein. This group had won a lawsuit against the Pirate Bay in 2009. However, the website hasn't complied with the verdict, stating that it had to prevent Dutch users from accessing the Pirate Bay. Like elsewhere in Europe, representatives of copyright holders here are now looking at filtering at ISP level as a solution. But even the ISPs themselves admit that the block doesn't really work. Niels Huibrechtse is spokesperson for Access4All.
It's very easy for people to find a way to get around this little fence. So people who really want to go to the Pirate Bay, they can. It's no problem at all. There's at least 1,000 ways to get around this block.
One of those ways around the blockade is visiting a mirrored website. The anti-piracy group Brein has tried to tackle these by sending out cease and desist letters to mirror websites that are based in the Netherlands. However, not every owner of a mirror site has received such notice, says the leader of the Dutch Pirate Party, Samir Aloui. His group started a mirror for the Pirate Bay too.
Not only the Dutch Pirate Party, but many people have set up so-called proxies, one of them being tpb.piratenpartij.nl, which is the domain of the Dutch Pirate Party. There it is. We're on the Pirate Bay now.
Brein declined to speak on tape for this story, but did provide written statements in answer to questions. The organization said that it sent out such letters to various sites and that around 10 had stopped illegal circumvention to block access to the Pirate Bay. This month, the two ISPs, Access4All and Ziggo, will begin their hearing at a court in The Hague on April 17th. One of their main arguments is that they say the original judicial order was overreaching. Again, Access4All's Niels Huibrechtse.
We're ordered to block three IP addresses of the Pirate Bay. Blocking an IP address is really much, much too broad a measure to take, because on one IP address there may be 100 or 1,000 or even 100,000 websites, and we don't know. If you block something without looking at it first, then it's clearly censorship.
There's an even bigger problem. The original ruling, they say, gives way too much power to Brain to arbitrarily decide what new sites are infringing.
We're given a list of domains and websites we're to block, and whenever Brain feels like it, they're allowed to send us a fax or a letter with additional addresses to be listed without Brain having to go to court first. This is something that's legally, it doesn't make sense. This is something you would perhaps expect in China, but not in the Netherlands.
But while Brain is defending its original favorable ruling, it's now also targeting four more Dutch ISPs, including KPN, Tele2, UPC and T-Mobile. Collectively with Ziggo and Access for All, they represent around 90% of the market. The companies have declined to comment on the ongoing case. But according to Peter Kager, an Amsterdam tech lawyer who's not involved in the case, these legal cases are essentially the only recourse that Brain has as a way to protect Dutch rights holders.
The Pirate Bay is illegal. There is at this moment no other way than blocking the Pirate Bay for the users in order to maintain the copyright of the copyright holders.
In a similar case in Finland, an anti-piracy group sued the largest ISP there, Elisa. Earlier this year, a Helsinki court required Elisa to block access to the Pirate Bay. Matthias Kastren is the head of Elisa's broadband subscription business.
These kind of, let's say, blockings will not have a very big effect on the, let's say, issue itself. The, let's say, only long-term solution is that the industry would be able to, let's say, provide easy-to-use services for customers.
Part of the problem is that even though the European Union is a single market in the physical world, it is less so in the digital world. While workers and people can travel, work and pay for physical goods with little difficulty, intellectual property law is still controlled at the national level. It seems unlikely that European anti-piracy cases like these will stop anytime soon. Access for All doesn't expect a verdict for the appeal before the end of the year. With regards to the new case, Brian expects a verdict within a couple of weeks. But if the previous case is any indication, ruling should not be expected before summer. Peter Teffer, DW, Amsterdam.
If you like, you can download Digital Europe as a separate podcast. Just search for DW Digital Europe in iTunes. Coming up, how to get your smartphone to speak sign language. But first, here's Dagmar Breitenbach with the news.
Australia's government-run science research agency has reached a multi-million dollar out-of-court settlement in the United States over the use of its wireless internet technology, which underpins Wi-Fi platforms worldwide. The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, the CSIRO, said the settlement for the wireless local area networking patent was worth more than $229 million. Commonly known as Wi-Fi, this wireless technology was invented by CSIRO scientists in the 1990s and is now used globally in over 3 billion computers, smartphones, and other internet-ready devices. The CSIRO began suing international corporations in 2005 for using the technology without a license. Scientists have discovered ways in which low doses of widely used pesticides and herbicides can be harmful to bumble and honeybees, interfering with their homing abilities, making them lose their way. In two studies published in the journal Science, British and French researchers looked at bees and neonicotinoid insecticides, a class introduced in the 1990s, now among the most commonly used crop pesticides in the world, and found to be harmful to the bee species. Astronomers hunting for rocky planets with the right temperature to support life estimate there may be tens of billions of them in our galaxy alone. A team of European scientists said about 40% of red dwarf stars, the most common type in the Milky Way, have a so-called super-Earth planet orbiting in a habitable zone that would allow water to flow on the surface. The ozone layer has slowly been recovering for some time, according to a recently published study that indicates a turning point may have been reached in the amount of ultraviolet radiation reaching the Earth's surface. The rise in UV radiation has been halted, according to Markus Rex, a physicist at Germany's Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research. The study points to a decrease in the amount of sulfur dioxide, a toxic gas responsible for acid rain, being released into the atmosphere as a reason for the recovery.
Dagmar Breitenbach there with this week's European Science and Technology News. You're listening to Spectrum on DW. I'm Jessie Wingard. Now, if you're like me and you're never near the actual radio, feel free to download Spectrum as a podcast. Take us with you on your commute or listen at your computer whenever you like. Every day when I walk to work, I always have my favourite DW podcast playing. It's a great way to keep up with what's going on. So head to dw.de/spectrum to listen. Russia is planning a Herculean task, drilling below ice to lay fibre optics underneath the Arctic Ocean. It says its goal is to create top-notch digital communications, but other Russia watchers say that the Kremlin has other motives. Jessica Gollaher reports from Moscow.
Three separate cable lines are planned to help drastically increase internet access between London and Tokyo. Two of the cables will be laid through the Northwest Passage and the other will be laid along Russia's long Arctic coast. Russia is expected to start construction on the first submarine cables next year. The cable is designed to prevent so-called choke points or an interruption in communications, making for better and faster internet. One of the Northwest Passage cables is expected to begin being laid this summer. Oleg Kuzbit is managing editor of Marchmont Innovation, dedicated to Russian technology news. Kuzbit says the Russian arm of the project, called PolarNet, is quite ambitious.
If you looked at this news about PolarNet, for instance, their capacity is just mind-boggling, which seems unrivaled in projects like this. The high speed of communication is the best choice for this kind of thing.
PolarNet says this is the shortest route from Europe to Asia at a distance of about 14,700 kilometers, about a third shorter than the next shortest route across the Indian Ocean. The cable is designed to have a staggering capacity of 9.6 terabytes per second. It aims to be more than twice as fast as the current rate from London to Tokyo, across the Indian Ocean, or across North America. That could be a boon for any internet user, as it would bring faster speeds at lower prices for anyone along its route. Plus, its proponents say the cable will hopefully take some pressure off the current choke points at the Straits of Malacca in Southeast Asia and across the Middle East. But high-speed communications come at a high price. The first phase of the project is estimated to cost nearly $900 million, and there are three phases in total. The cost, coupled with freezing Arctic temperatures and thousands of kilometers of ice, also makes this an extremely difficult project to undertake. Again, Oleg Kuzbit.
Looks like the Russian government has some solution. There will be some special ships used to with some deep underwater equipment. So I guess they are well prepared for this kind of thing. Of course, that will take time and that will take quite a lot of money. But they seem to be determined to complete this.
But why is Russia determined to spend so much time and money on a project to increase internet service for the average Russian? Well, they aren't, according to Kuzbit.
To my mind, the Kremlin first and foremost believes the Arctic is important as a strategic area to keep some military upper hand. This is probably a platform or a place, a huge place to really command some strategic endeavors regarding all the neighbors that are involved in that area, including Western Europe and North America. So I do not think that the Kremlin is particularly interested to ease communication between England and Japan.
In fact, the Ministry of Communications has said as much. In a press release issued last fall, Igor Shegalov, the Minister of Communications, said that strengthening Russia's northern borders was strategically important. That's why the country needs to develop communication technology along the Arctic region. The government has also said that by putting cables in the Arctic, which for now is relatively free of shipping traffic, won't be as much at risk to break down.
Well, you know, if you look at the geographical map, you'll see that Arctic is an important, critically important region for the country.
That's Andrei Kortunov. He's the president of the New Eurasia Foundation, a think tank based here in Moscow. He says that the Arctic holds not only political but monetary importance.
Russia faces this region directly. It is by far the largest Arctic country in the world. It is indeed the longest Russian border. If you consider the mineral resources in this particular part of the country, it's clear that Russia is not the only country that is interested in this part of the world, and it is critically important to make sure that this region will be a place for international cooperation rather than competition.
One of Russia's main competitors in the region is Canada. Both countries claim a certain stretch of the Arctic Ocean belongs to them. The area is believed to contain vast amounts of mineral wealth and possibly oil. And as Oleg Kuzbit with Marchmont explains, this advanced technology project sounds great, but it doesn't really help Russia keep up with other countries' innovation efforts.
Russian technology, partially inherited from the Soviet past, has been a terrific thing in general. But the only problem is that technology commercialization is far behind the use of technology in government purposes, for government purposes.
In other words, while the Kremlin has been good at planning government-run tech, think Sputnik. There are few examples of products or services that have made it to the masses. Still, Moscow is moving full steam ahead. Phase 1 is expected to be completed by 2014. Jessica Gallagher, DW, Moscow.
And finally today, let's talk sign language. Scientists from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland have announced the forthcoming release of the Portable Sign Language Translator, or PSLT, a new software application that could be used to translate from various sign languages into written English through gesture recognition technology. The founders of Technabling, the Scottish startup behind the PSLT, say that they have been working on it for more than a year now and hope to make it available by 2013. To learn more, former Spectrum host Sarus Farava spoke with Ernesto Compantangelo. He's a lecturer in computing science at the University of Aberdeen and is the founder of Technabling. Sarus started by asking him what the Portable Sign Language Translator actually is.
The Portable Sign Language Translator is a software-based device that runs on a number of platforms from Android smartphones down to desktops, which does exactly what it says on the title or on the tin. It translates sign language into text, or better, any sentence that's signed and then the signer poses is translated into a plain English sentence that appears on a video device, which could be the same device where the signing is captured or a remote device elsewhere.
So if I'm speaking to you in sign language and you have a portable sign language translator in your hand, how would you use it?
Well, basically, I mean, you put the, say you have an Android smartphone, you put the Android smartphone somewhere, you sign in front of it, and then on the very same side, on the opposite side, depending which camera you're using, we can use both if they are available, you would see immediately the sentence appearing on the screen. Same happens if you have a laptop, desktop, tablet, PC, or anything else.
So, in effect, what it's using is kind of gesture recognition, is that right?
Exactly correct. So gestures are recognized, and then depending on the sequence of gestures and the fact that you pose at the end of, say, what's a signed sentence, the English sentence corresponding to what you have said in terms of signs will appear immediately.
Now, I know that there are different types of sign languages in use around the world. Which sign languages do you support for the time being?
We support a number of them. So basically, potentially, the PSLT can accept any kind of sign language. Obviously, you have to start from somewhere, and we started with the British Sign Language and Makaton. But this is purely coincidental in the sense that the system is fully customizable, so we can load different libraries corresponding to different sign languages or regional variations of these sign languages.
So is this product available now? Can people download it?
Not yet. We are now spending this year and the first half of the next year to transform this proof of concept into a fully fledged commercial version of it. And this will be available for commercially available in the second half of 2013.
Do you have any sense at this point as to how this would become available or how much it would cost?
Well, it very likely we will make it available for download through the various, we would have various opportunities. First and foremost, you can think about e-commerce websites where you can go and download it directly. In terms of cost, we haven't decided yet, but definitely given the kind of customer base, we want to have something which is very affordable. So in terms of pounds or euros or dollars, we're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of them. We're also exploring alleys where this product could be, for instance, provided by the National Health Service or similar government-based services, so in which case it would be provided at the point of delivery for free.
Now, I understand that with machine translation, and I suppose this is just a different type of machine translation, going from a gestural language to a spoken or written language, it's my understanding that with machine translation like we would use in Google Translate, is that when something like that, the way that works is that it takes blocks of text that it has scanned, that the software has scanned in both languages that have been translated by a human being, and then converts those into whatever the target language is. And a company like Google, of course, it's not 100% perfect, but often gives a approximation, or in some cases better than an approximation of what's being said.
I would like to point out that the way the translation from sign language into text is a slightly different kind of thing. The reason being that if you translate, say, for a language, imagine German, into another language, imagine English, you have roughly the same expressive power. It's just that the way of assembling the set of symbols, which are the words, is different. The grammar makes the difference, but you have a similar expressive power. Sign languages are much less expressive than written or verbal language. And so on top of the translation, we have a process of enrichment, so beefing up the whole thing. A typical example: if you say in sign language, well, tomorrow I will have to go to the supermarket to buy some food, the way it is signed is something like, tomorrow me go supermarket buy food. So you understand that the expressiveness of such language, although the main concepts are there, is much more limited.
Just one last thing. Do you expect this tool to be used, or do you think that this tool could be adapted to be used as a way to teach people sign language?
Definitely, yes. I mean, this is one of the side effects of the whole thing. Because you can say you use a desktop or a laptop and you have your webcam that faces you, and you also have the result that comes out on the screen in front of you. So it's a way like another of trying whether your gestures are correct, because you would immediately see what comes out of it, and what comes out of it may be exactly what you have in mind or something different. So you may reflect on the fact that maybe what you are signing is not exactly how it should be done. So it's a self-learning tool, yes.
Cyrus Faraba there, speaking with Ernesto Compantangelo, a lecturer in computer science at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland and founder of Technabling, makers of the PSLT. That's all for this week on Spectrum. Want to learn more about something you heard on the show? Send us a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. In between episodes, you can find daily news updates at dw.de/science. Email your questions and comments to feedback.english@dw.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. If you like, you can also send us a postcard or a letter to Deutsche Welle, Spectrum, English Service, 53110 Bonn, Germany. Thank you to today's studio team, Mike and Ileana. From DW in Bonn, Germany, I'm Jesse Wingard, and thanks for listening.